Welcome to this lecture this evening. It's the first part of a meeting that will begin tomorrow morning on In Times of Crisis, Can We Trust the Courts? We have two presenters here. Just let me tell you a brief word about them. Professor A.W. Brian Simpson is the Charles and Edith Klein Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School, and he has held professorships at the University of Kent, the University of Cambridge, the University of Chicago, the University of Ghana, and now the Aspen Institute. He will be followed by Daniel Butt, who is fellow and tutor in politics at Oriel College and program director of the Courts and the Making of Public Policy. This program is being organized and sponsored both by the Aspen Institute Justice and Society Program, of which, by the way, hello, I'm Alice Henkin, and I'm the director of that program. And we are doing it jointly with the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society, a not-for-profit think tank based in Oxford, England. Daniel Butt is going to say a few words first to put the context of this lecture, and then Professor Simpson is going to give his talk, and then Mr. Butt is going to come back and say a few words. And then if there's time, we will have some questions and presumably answers. And the questions should come from those who are not participating in the program that begins tomorrow morning. You'll get your chance later.
Thank you, Alice. I'm just going to say a couple of words of introduction prior to asking Professor Simpson to speak. The program on the courts and their role in the public policy process has been running in the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society for about 2 years now. And this is the latest in a series of events which we've organised in order to try to bring together both academics and policymakers, people involved in the real world theory and practice of law, to bring these different parties together to try to think about the extent to which courts can and should affect the public policy process in modern-day states. This is the second event which we've organised in Aspen. The first event last year focused on the role of the courts in the public policy process in the United States specifically. We had three sessions, one looking at education policy, one looking at reproductive rights, and a third session on national security. And it was really as a result of that last session on national security that the workshop over the next 2 days and today's lecture had their genesis. It became clear in the course of that workshop that certain forms of crisis, be they political crises, communal crises, or crises relating to national security, raise a number of very different issues in relation to the court's role in the public policy process. After Professor Simpson's talk, I'm going to say something linking what he said into the wider program of the work of the Foundation on Courts and Public Policy. But without further ado, Professor Simpson.
Well, good evening. I'm going to talk about locking up people without trial, detention by the executive in World War II in Britain, and then move on to say a little bit about what the position in Britain is today. During the war, the British government locked up something of the order of 1,800 of its own citizens. That's a number that corresponds, for example, to the Japanese Americans who were detained in the Second World War. We also locked up something like 27,000 was the peak number of enemy aliens, that is to say, people of Austrian or German nationality or later Italian nationality, many of them, in fact, refugees. But I'm not going to talk about that group at all. Why do governments want to lock up people without trial? Well, the obvious explanation is preventive. Criminal law basically works on shutting the stable door after the horse has left. You wait till the murder occurs, and then you lock somebody up or shoot them, whatever you do to them. In times of crisis, the argument is you must act before people do bad things, and that's an obvious justification. But that's not the only reason why people are detained without trial. One is cases where you couldn't get a conviction in ordinary criminal proceedings. For example, you might have evidence you couldn't produce, or you might not have enough evidence to satisfy the burden of proof. So that's a second reason. A third reason, which is rather unpleasant, is that once you've got somebody locked up without trial, especially if you keep them incommunicado, you can do nasty things to them by way of intensive interrogation or, if you like, torture them. And so detention without trial is always associated with intense interrogation, not to use a stronger term. And further reason is, in times of crisis, governments like to give the impression they're doing something active and positive, tough. And so, in times of crisis, locking up people without trial is one such gesture of tough action, to show the government is vigilant and active. Detention without trial can also be used to instill fear into a group in society which you in yourself fear. And finally, given all the advantages of locking up people without trial, wherever you get this institution, you tend to get the practice now known as extraordinary rendition, that is, scooping up people from various other countries and on the high seas and so forth and popping them into detention. And the UK government did a little of that in the Second World War. It's very hard to find out how many people were scooped up in that way, probably about four or five, but it did happen. Why did the British government decide to lock up so many of its own citizens? Well, in the early years of the war, which in Britain, of course, started in 1939, it was called the phony war. Not a great deal happened. And all the power of detention did exist. Very few people were detained. At the end of April 1940, there were only 58 people of British citizenship in detention. Then in May, June, July 1940, it all changed. Why? Well, you've got to remember the conditions of the time. Germany took over control of Denmark and virtually total control of Norway in a single day. A single day. The attack in the West started on May the 10th. By May the 19th, the British Expeditionary Force was surrounded. By 4th of June, the evacuation through Dunkirk was over, and on the 10th of June, the French government collapsed. The German army was 22 miles away from Britain and could even shell Dover across the Straits. For this extraordinary event, there had to be an explanation. And the explanation, which was very, very popular and widely believed, was it was all because of the existence of an organized fifth column consisting of anything from nuns with submachine guns under their habits to domestic servants with bombs and so forth and so on. That was widely believed. And the shadowy organized fifth column, everywhere and nowhere, the more sinister, the less clear evidence there was for its existence, generated fear. You may think of echoes of recent history in America. In these desperate conditions, no risks could be taken in Britain over a possible fifth column. And so, in this spirit, detention came to be used on a massive scale. Most massive in relation to the enemy aliens, much less massive in relation to British citizens. I wrote a book on the subject, and I used as its title, In the Highest Degree Odious, because old Winston Churchill, later in the war, said, the power to detain people without trial is in the highest degree odious. Winston was right behind it in 1940. He regretted it, but he had been behind it. Now, the power to detain citizens had been in existence well before 1940. In 1939, legislation was promoted under which regulations could be made allowing for the detention of British citizens. And the regulation was called 18B, and the original regulation said that if the Secretary of State, that means, in effect, the Home Secretary, the minister in charge of home affairs in Britain, was satisfied that it was necessary to make a detention order to prevent a person acting in a way which was prejudicial to the public safety or the defence of the realm, he could lock them up without trial. And there was a public outcry against this wide power. And so the original regulation was withdrawn, there was a heated debate in the House of Commons, and a new regulation was brought in, and I won't go through it in very great detail, but it basically said that if the Home Secretary had reasonable cause to believe that somebody was either of hostile origin or associations, and that meant a de facto enemy alien, or had been recently engaged in acts prejudicial to the public safety and so forth, and if he was satisfied, reasonably satisfied, that it was necessary to do so, he could make a detention order. So it was a much more elaborate text of the regulation, and various safeguards were brought in. Arrangements were made to set up an advisory committee which would meet and advise the Home Secretary on whether people detained should be let out and so forth. There were to be reports to Parliament every so often. The detainees were to be given the grounds and particulars of their detention and so forth and so on. So what happened was a compromise between the wishes of the security arm of the state to lock up people without trial, and the feeling that such a power should be carefully constrained. What role the courts were to play in this was left very obscure. Certainly some people thought, after the new regulation came in, that there was some power of judicial review of detention orders. And there's no doubt that habeas corpus was never suspended. But what this power of review would amount to was left somewhat obscure. Some other things reassured the public. The chairman of the advisory committee was appointed was a very well-known lawyer, Norman Burkus, best known as a defence lawyer. He was a sort of a good chap in British terms, a good cricketer, for example, a safe pair of hands. And so the appointment of this very well-known, largely defence barrister to chair the advisory committee reassured people that the system would be worked out with the minimum interference with civil liberty that was necessary for public security. In the early years of the war, this power of detention was used very few cases, and they were all cases where people were suspected of spying or involvement in espionage in one way or another. In May 1940, in response to the fifth column panic, the whole thing changed. And they also passed a new 18B regulation, especially targeted against the British Fascist Party. There was in Britain the British Union of Fascists. The head of it was Oswald Mosley. His son is the guy recently in some trouble about pornographic films in connection with the running of Formula One racing. And his wife was Diana, one of the Mitford girls. You probably know of the Mitford girls. One fell in love with Hitler. Diana also fell slightly in love with Hitler and so on. One of them became an active communist. Nancy wrote wonderful novels. They're an extraordinary group of women. The British Union of Fascists was, of course, the nearest thing the British had to a Nazi party. And so it was feared, and there was great public hostility against it. And so they introduced a regulation which was specifically targeted against the British Union of Fascists. They had to produce a new regulation because they hadn't any evidence that the fascists had been engaged in acts prejudicial and they weren't of hostile origin associations. And the regulation could also be used against other bizarre fascist groups in Britain. One of the weirdest was the Imperial Fascist League, run by a man called Arnold Lees, who was the world's expert on the diseases of camels. Very strange creature. And there were other little parties of this sort. A word or two about the British Union of Fascists. It was violently unpopular in 1940. It was a largely defunct organisation, but it was hated. But it wasn't of any very great significance. The organisation that was of considerable significance was the Communist Party, which at this time, because, of course, Hitler hadn't attacked Russia at this time, was campaigning against the war. And certainly some members of the Communist Party were engaged in sabotage in factories and that sort of thing. But nothing was done about the Communist Party because it thought it would produce labour disputes of a very serious character and it was best to do nothing about it. And anyway, it wasn't a fascist group. Well, by late 1941, it became apparent that the sinister Fifth Column was a myth. There were, of course, only a tiny handful of people in Britain who engaged in disloyal activities. There were some, but you could get them all on the platform of this room. In fact, there'd be room to spare if you did. So the whole system began to be run down. Initially, it was chaotic because of administrative overload. The bureaucracy just could not deal with 1,800 or so British citizens all making their applications to the advisory committee, all having to be housed in prisons and that sort of thing, all having to be arrested. But the main pressure on the bureaucracy wasn't the British citizens. It was the 27,000 or so enemy aliens, who, as I say, were mainly Jewish refugees. But it was feared at the time that there might be spies amongst them. There was, in fact, one spy amongst them, but he wasn't a Nazi. He was later a spy, Klaus Fuchs, the guy who handed over a lot of information about the atomic bomb to Russia, was one of those people detained in 1940. And after the administrative chaos was sorted out, they began to be released. By the end of 1941, there were 647. By 1942, 486. By 1943, 266. By the end of 1944, only 65. And in April 1945, only 11. They included some odd people. One was Audrey Hepburn's father, Hepburn Rushton. He was a guy of probably partly Asian extraction. And if you look at Audrey Hepburn's pictures and so on, she has those beautiful high cheekbones, and you've only got to look at her to see, yes, there's a bit of Asian blood going to produce that beautiful face which we all adored in the movies and so forth. So they were let out. Now, some of these people were nasty, some were very nasty, some were potty, some, for example, set up an institution for the worship of God as the Messiah. Some were mentally disturbed, some seriously misguided, and some would have engaged in acts of sabotage and disloyalty if they hadn't been locked up. But virtually none of them represented any serious danger. Another thing that was feared was that Germany possessed a huge underground spy ring in Britain. It took to 1944 for the Security Service to eventually become convinced that there never had been such a spy ring. And the more they hunted and the less information they got, the more sinister the spy ring was. Now, there were some spies in Britain. They were dropped by parachute or arrived by boat, and virtually all were picked up in a very short time. One actually went into an English pub and asked for a cup of coffee at 9:30 in the morning. He was in custody within about 10 minutes. As the system wound down, there were serious conflicts between the British Security Service, which is usually called MI5, the Internal Secret Service, and Birkett's Committee and the Home Office. But in the end, liberal ideas triumphed, but they took a fair time. And at the end of the war, all the detainees were released. The security service wanted to keep some of them in permanent detention, but Winston wouldn't have it. One of the last people who released was an entertaining character, but not very nice, called Banco Jelish. He was the guy who probably organized the assassination of King Alexander in Marseille in 1934, an incident which led to the first attempt to produce an international convention against terrorism. The British, he was extraordinary rendition, he was travelling from Italy to New York to raise funds for his Croatian separatist movement, and the British picked him up off the ship and brought him home to England and kept him in detention. And the only other fact I know about him was that he had very poor personal hygiene, and old detainees who I interviewed for my book spoke feelingly about the fact he was quite a good medical doctor, but he didn't half smell. Now, what about severe interrogation or torture? In 1940, the Security Service illegally set up an interrogation centre at a place called Latchmere House, which still exists on the western side of London. And it was mainly used for the interrogation of suspected spies. But in 1940, about 35 18B detainees were sent there. Now, why were they sent there? They were sent there for severe interrogation. And this was because the Security Service, having pressed for the internment of British citizens because of this fifth column and so forth, were desperate to get some evidence that the thing actually existed. And so they popped these people into Latchmere House and interrogated them, and they came up with no evidence for an organised fifth column. There were protests about this because it became public knowledge, and they stopped sending British citizens there at the end of 1940. For suspected spies, the interrogation methods there were extremely effective, and spies who were caught in Britain in the war were either executed or coerced into becoming double agents, or if they really hadn't got much against them, they were simply detained till the end of the war. The system used there did not involve physical torture. It was devised by a psychiatrist, and it involved things like long silences, lights going out, being moved about for no apparent reason, getting no information, talk of hanging and shooting parties, that sort of thing, good man, good guy, bad guy techniques. But they were very effective. And an account of this place is now in print, written by the guy who ran it, who was a very nasty piece of work, but very effective, who was known as Tin Eye Stevens. And Tin Eye Stevens got his name because he had a monocle, and he used to glower at these people and interrogate them. Now, we're here to consider the role of courts. So what can we say about that? In the war, habeas corpus proceedings were not banned. So you could bring habeas corpus. Habeas corpus proceedings were mainly determined on the basis of affidavits, not on oral evidence or cross-examination or anything of that sort. And in a number of detainees did turn to the courts for redress. And the first case involved a guy called Lees, who was not a nice piece of work. And he'd been detained on the ground, and he'd been told he'd been detained on the ground that he was a member of the British Union of Fascists. And he wasn't, and he never had been a member of the British Union of Fascists. And the killing came before the court, and the court said that they had a power to investigate the legality and the grounds of detention. But the way they investigated it was simply by looking at the affidavits put in by the detainee, who pointed out he wasn't a member of the British Union of Fascists, and an affidavit drafted by lawyers put in by the Home Secretary, which was very cunningly drafted, and it was drafted to say that the Home Secretary, at the time he made the order, had reasonable cause to believe that he was a member of the Fascist Party. And that was true. At the time when he made the order, he got it wrong. So the affidavit was perfectly true. It was drafted by a rather ingenious lawyer called Valentine Holmes. And the court said, OK, that answers the claim. The affidavit from the Home Secretary is sufficient. And the trouble is this, really. If the court was to have a power of review, there was bound to be a problem arising in the following way, that the security service would act on evidence from agents and that sort of thing, and also from hearsay and material which couldn't really be satisfactorily put before a court. And the security service was always extremely hostile to placing the basis on which it had recommended detention before the courts, or indeed before anybody else. And so, although the court said there was this power to review the case, they didn't really address the problem of how they were supposed to do that. For example, there would be a file on the detainee produced by the security service. There would be a file produced by the inside the Home Office. If the case went to the advisory committee, there'd be a file produced by the advisory committee. Which of this body of papers was going to be available to the court? And the short answer was none at all, if the security service could possibly bring that about. And it came to be settled that an affidavit from the Home Office rehearsing that the Home Secretary had reasonable cause to believe, he'd seen reports and he had cause to believe, was a sufficient answer to habeas corpus. It was settled that if some gross error came to light, for example, if they'd arrested the wrong man, there was a mistake as to identity, the court would order release. No such case ever actually came before the courts, though there were numerous cases of mistaken identity, but the people were all released without court proceedings before that. There was one case in which a small-time crook called Harry Sabini had been detained on the say-so of the London Metropolitan Police, who didn't like him because he was a troublemaker on racetracks and so on. And he claimed that this was a case of mistaken identity, but it turned out that it wasn't. It was also a plain case of gross abuse of the regulation. There was absolutely no security ground for arresting this guy at all. But the London police thought it was an opportunity to get him out of the way. They'd been after him for years, and this was a good chance, and so on. And he was subsequently let out. Then the whole thing came up in a great case involving a guy called Robert Liversidge. Robert Liversidge was, at the time of his arrest, an RAF intelligence officer in Fighter Command headquarters. And in the case, the House of Lords judges upheld his detention in habeas corpus proceedings, but one judge, Lord Atkin, dissented. And Lord Atkin's dissent has always become a sort of part of the folklore of the English legal profession, that here was a judge prepared to stand up for civil liberties. I don't see how there's much in that, but I'll come back to it. What about Robert Liversidge? Well, he came from a Jewish family which had emigrated to England in the 1890s. The family name was Perlzweig, and they produced some very distinguished Jewish citizens and so forth. He changed his name to Liversidge, and he'd had what you might call an exciting and rather dodgy life. I spent hours talking to him on the telephone. He was holed up at the time in Vancouver, having been kicked out by his nth wife, and he was very sore. And he poured out information to me. He wouldn't ever be interviewed, and I never got quite clear what things he had been involved in, but he'd become a very successful businessman, and he certainly had some dodgy contacts. He'd never been convicted of any criminal offence, and probably in order to do the right thing, because some members of his family rather disapproved of him, he decided to join the RAF. And at one point in his career, he'd got a Canadian passport, and to get the passport, he's falsified his date of birth and his birth original name. And he used the same false statement in his application to join the Air Force. And he became a very, very successful intelligence officer and ended up at Fighter Command headquarters. And in various ways, the false statements came to light. And the Air Force took against him, and they thought this guy is unreliable, and he's got secret information. And it's possible that it was suspected that he had knowledge about the breaking of the German Enigma codes, which he shouldn't have had. That's a possible ground for the RAF suspicion. There were, incidentally, only two big secrets in Britain in the war. One was the fact that we'd broken the German Enigma codes, and the other was the date and location of D-Day. These were the two big secrets which really mattered. Anyway, the Air Force eventually secured his detention, and since they couldn't prove he'd been engaged in acts prejudicial, and he wasn't a member of the British Union of Fascists, far from it, he hated the fascists, he was locked up as being as hostile associations. And he came up before the advisory committee, and the advisory committee took the ground that most of the allegations of his unreliability were groundless, that he certainly wasn't of a disloyal person. They said that the argument that he was hostile associations was extremely thin and difficult. But the advisory committee was not prepared to recommend his release against the wishes of the Air Force. Why? Because at the time they did their report was the height of the Battle of Britain, and it had not yet been won. And so nobody at that point was going to release somebody who'd been an intelligence officer at Fighter Command headquarters who had any sort of dodgy history or risk that he might release secrets. So that was the background to it. And so he went to the courts, and the House of Lords, it went up to the top court, the House of Lords, and they ruled that an 18B order could only be impugned in the courts, either on the ground of mistaken identity, and nothing of the sort occurred in Liversidge's case, or on the ground of fraud. And it was, of course, totally impossible for a detainee to prove fraud against the British Home Secretary, nor, to be fair to them, did British Home Secretaries engage in fraud. So the fraud thing meant nothing at all. The House of Lords went even further. They said that the Home Secretary didn't need to produce these elaborate affidavits anymore. The court, from the fact that the Home Secretary had made the order, would presume that he had acted legally and therefore had reasonable cause to suppose that the person needed locking up and so on. So from that case onwards, the Home Office could win a case simply by producing the order in answer to an action, proceedings and habeas corpus proceedings. So essentially, the courts washed their hands of protecting civil liberty for 18B detainees. Now, some people think that was a bad, evil thing for them to do. And since Lord Atkin dissented in the case, they say, well, at least one judge was prepared to stand up for civil liberties. But actually, Lord Atkin was perfectly happy to go along with the majority so long as the Home Office put in one of these affidavits. So there wasn't really a tremendous difference between them. But it wasn't really a clash between bad judges and so on. Nothing to do with that at all. It was because they adopted a certain view of the constitutional role of judges in security cases. And it's best summed up by an English judge a few years later called Lord Denning. And he said this, old Alfred Lord Denning always said things in a broad Somerset accent, but I won't try to imitate it. There is a conflict, he'd have said. Where is a conflict between the interests of national security on the one hand and the freedom of the individual on the other? The balance between these two is not for a court of law. It is for the Home Secretary. He is the person entrusted. So they really adopted a sort of constitutional position on this, that it was just not part of the role of the courts. Now, before I go on and say a little bit more, you may wonder what happened to old Robert Liversidge. Well, by the time the case was decided, saying he could be locked up, nobody wanted him locked up. So they immediately let him go, and he lived out the rest of the war and prospered after the war as a businessman and remained outraged by his detention up to the last time I spoke to him. As for the detainees, well, they were progressively released. Now, various factors worked in favour of their release. Some people say the way to secure civil liberties in these cases is by the separation of powers. I don't really believe that. I take more comfort from a view produced many years ago by an international lawyer called Charles de Visscher, Belgian. And he argued, and I'll just summarise his argument, that in a free society, what you've got to have is various groups, all independent or partially independent of each other, all pushing their own agenda in their own ways and so forth, and that it's the interrelationship with all these different groups that produces a decent free society. And, for example, who were they? The security service, pressing for detention, but in its own way, acting within its own lights, responsibly. The Foreign Office, very hostile to the excessive use of detention, particularly for aliens. The Home Office, which at that time had very liberal-minded civil servants in it, I wouldn't say the same today. Birkett's Committee, the courts. The authorities were very nervous of falling foul of the courts. Very, very nervous. Because court proceedings were in public, and so they'd want a scandal. A group of liberal-minded members of Parliament, particularly a man called Richard Stokes, who campaigned endlessly for the release of detainees. The newspapers, oscillating in 1940, lock them up. By 1943, let them go. Charitable organisations who helped their families, and even former detainees who, after release, because there was liberty of expression, wrote little documents and pamphlets and so forth, attacking the system. And so, in the end, what you got was a sort of compromise solution. If you think about the USA today, that's what's happening. Compromise is at last beginning to emerge. There was a period, I'm afraid, when compromise seemed to go right down the tubes. But compromise is beginning, and that's what happened. Now, how are the English courts conceived of their role today? Well, since then, things have dramatically changed, and I'll just very shortly summarise why. First of all, the power of judicial review of decisions by the executive has been very, very much extended. This development has taken place over the last 50 years. It was pushed partly by academic writing, it was partly by other factors. The second is that the English courts have developed a positive theory of individual rights. That is to say, English courts now reason in cases from saying, well, is some right involved in this case? If so, what are the bounds and limits of the right? Has the right been violated in some improper way? What, if any, remedy can we provide? That way of reasoning simply didn't exist back in the 1940s. So that's the second big change. In fact, it was said by one English writer that English judges in the past, back in the mid-years of the last century, conceived of rights as simply gaps in the criminal law. Things there wasn't a law. If you weren't committing a criminal offence by doing something, then you had a right to do it. That came out classically in an early case on telephone tapping, where a judge called McGarry, who was a numbingly competent lawyer, but had never had a thought in his head, and they tapped telephones, you see, and the Home Office thought they could only do that with a special warrant signed by the Home Secretary, and telephonists, in those days it was manual exchanges, they were sacked if they eavesdropped on conversations. But just McGarry said, well, now, you know, telephone tapping, did the Home Office enter the guy's house and mess about with his telephone? No, no. Did he commit any crime? No. Was it a breach of contract? Nothing in the old contract would you get a telephone saying my phone won't be tapped. So you've ticked off the boxes. He said, no, Home Secretary's got a perfect right to tap people's telephones. And that was the way of looking at it. So that has changed. Now, the other thing that's changed is that we have incorporated into English law the provisions of the European Convention. And English judges can now apply in adjudication the law of the European Convention on Human Rights and the enormous case law which has developed around it. And that has brought a rights-based legal culture into the decisions of the English courts in a quite dramatic way. And we recently had an example of this. The government wanted to lock up some people who they suspected, and I'll argue about whether they were right or wrong, were being engaged in international terrorist movements of an Islamic basis. And they wanted, these were not British citizens, and they wanted to deport them, but they couldn't deport them because under the European Convention you're not allowed to deport people to countries where they run a serious risk of being tortured or otherwise subjected to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. So they said, well, we can't deport them. We don't want to let them go. What are we going to do with them? So they introduced a system of detention without trial. And the system of detention without trial they introduced was, in order, for political reasons really, limited to detention without trial for people who didn't enjoy British citizenship. And this went up to the House of Lords, and they ruled, no, you can't do this, because under the European Convention provisions which we now apply, you can't discriminate between people within your jurisdiction in the protection of their rights. And this interferes with the rights of these people under the European Convention, and the provisions were discriminatory. And so the British government had to dismantle the system. The court, incidentally, couldn't rule that the legislation was actually invalid. All they could rule was that it was contrary to the European Convention, and the government then had to think again and introduce a new system. And what they've actually done is let them out under very severe control restrictions. And those control restrictions may, in their turn, be challenged before the European Court of Human Rights. Now, there is unease about all this in Britain because people say, well, look at these people. They're dangerous. Why can't we kick them out? Why should we not kick them out just because of this stupid European Convention? And the popular view is that arguments like, oh, well, because your government agreed to it, don't really carry much ice. But in fact, European countries, organized through the Council of Europe in this particular case, because that's the organization which produced the European Convention, have in fact promoted a considerable body of legislation on international cooperation to deal with terrorist threats. And I can't go into it tonight, but they've also produced elaborate guidelines of recommendations to European countries as to how they should combat terrorism without violating the basic fundamentals of the idea of the rule of law and the idea of a free society. Whether they've got the balance right and so on, you can always argue about these things, but that's the approach. And you must realise in looking at this that terrorism is not some sort of recent invention. There's been terrorism going on, and international terrorism, for a very long time. European countries have had to put up with a lot of it. For example, Spain had to put up with a serious terrorist outrage in Madrid. There's been terrorism in connection with the Corsican independence movement. There's the Basque separatist movement. And so this has been going on for a long time. And so they've tried to grapple with the problem of dealing with this. Some people think that terrorism is such a threat to the existence of free society is that very draconian measures are justifiable. I rather inclined to a view set out by a House of Lords judge, though it went beyond what his colleague said in the detention case. And he said this, he was a judge called Lord Hoffman, this is a nation which has been tested in adversity and will survive physical destruction and catastrophic loss of life. I do not underestimate the ability of fanatical terrorists to kill and destroy, but they do not threaten the life of the nation. Whether we would survive Hitler hung in the balance, but there's no doubt we'll survive Al-Qaeda. The Spanish people have not said that what happened in Madrid, hideous crime though it was, threatened the life of their nation. Their legendary pride would not allow it. Terrorist violence, serious as it is, does not threaten our institutions. And then he went on to say something which made him very, very unpopular with some elements in Britain and in the USA. The real threat to the life of the nation is laws such as these. Now that's a rather extreme statement, if you like, for which he's been heavily criticised by, for example, my friend Judge Richard Posner. But it's a view which I have some sort of sympathy with, and I'll stop at that point.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Simpson. It may disappoint some of you to hear that I'm not going to engage in a point-to-point rebuttal of the historical claims Professor Simpson made. So if you are looking to me to challenge his views on the racial heritage of Audrey Hepburn or the personal hygiene of detainees during the Second World War in the UK, I fear you'll be disappointed. Instead, just for a few minutes before we open up to questions for Professor Simpson, I wanted to put his wonderful talk in the context of the wider question that we're going to be looking at in our seminar over the next 2 days in terms of whether in times of crisis we can trust the courts, and maybe just suggest three questions that we can think about in that context. Thus far in the course of the work of the programme on courts and the making of public policy, when we've debated questions about the intervention of the courts into the public policy process, we've tended to conceive of the issue as being one of legislatures against judiciaries. So that's the way these problems are normally conceived, I think. And it raises, one might say, two broad areas of inquiry. One pertaining to the legitimacy of the courts, whether it's, for example, democratically justifiable for them to try to replace the judgments of democratically elected assemblies, and questions of competence, whether the policies that emerge from judicial intervention in the public policy-making process are good policies, whether they're good interventions. But I think one thing that's come very clearly from Professor Simpson's talk is that when we come to look at the role of the courts in times of crisis and in relation to crises of national security in particular, it isn't really the courts against the legislature which is the issue. It's primarily the courts against the executive. And this raises a number of different issues. It changes the nature of the problem, I think. Certainly it affects, for example, the issue of legitimacy if it's not directly elected representative the courts are going up against. But also, as I'll suggest, it affects issues relating to competence in terms of the ability of the courts to intervene in the public policy process. So I want to maybe just raise three questions, perhaps three different ways in which we can interpret the question in times of crisis. Can we trust the courts? The first of these is the question of whether, when it comes to very difficult cases that come before the courts in times of these sorts of crises we might think now of national security in particular, whether we can trust the courts to come to what we take to be the right decision. So are their judgments the ones that we would want them to make in these cases? And of course, the answer to that question will depend to a large extent on what answers we want to get out of the courts. So in relation to national security, whether we see their role as being one of bulwarks of civil liberties, acting against an overreaching executive in order to uphold individual rights. So are we trusting them to come to those kind of decisions? Or instead, are we trusting them not to undermine national security? Are we trusting them not to put the particular rights of a few individuals ahead of the common good? And obviously, depending on where we think the balance of interest lies between those two, we'll have different views on whether and to what extent we can trust the courts. Now, some of these questions will depend on the particular context of particular jurisdictions. Insofar as we're talking about courts up against executives, there may be broad similarities in different cases relating to, for example, the adjudicative method of reasoning. But if we look in particular at the national security situation and contexts such as detention without trial, I think we can see some real issues that arise as to the competency of judges to make decisions. And this reflects this point that they're up against, in a sense, the executive rather than the legislature. Political scientists often find it very hard to study executives. Executives are typically opaque institutions. They don't necessarily show their working. They don't operate in a public context with open hearings and debates in the same way as legislatures often do. And so if it's the executive which the courts are scrutinising, often they're scrutinising decisions taken behind closed doors. And if it's decisions made in the context of national security, there's often a very open question as to how much they can even be told about the content of these decisions. And certainly this is what we saw in the Second World War cases, where in fact the information that was being disclosed to the courts was pretty much entirely at the discretion of the security services. And so I think what often emerges in these cases is the courts being asked to rule on the reasonableness of executive action when they have very little detail as to the reasoning behind the executive action in the first place. And they're often asked to take rather a lot on trust from the security services and from the executive. And when the courts get engaged in this kind of reasoning, reasoning about reasonableness rather than necessarily about principle, it can be much harder to make these decisions. Maybe this isn't the proper role of the courts. So to take an example from the current debate in the United Kingdom, there's currently a big dispute in the UK about whether the detention period for terrorist suspects should be extended from the current limit of 28 days to a new limit of 42 days. Now, this is a very controversial question, and it's aroused a great deal of controversy within Parliament. But it's hard to see quite how this is a matter of principle in a classical sense. One can certainly see that a matter of principle was involved in the question of whether, for example, terrorist suspects should be treated in the same way as different criminals, or whether extra time should be given to question them. But if it becomes a question of whether it should be 28 days or 42 days, we're asking a decision to be made not so much on principle, but a balancing decision to be made between the interests of the civil liberties of individuals and the interests of national security. And if it's that kind of judgment, a balancing judgment, then we might think that it's very hard for people to make those decisions without a great deal of information of the precise risks and a great deal of experience as to precisely what is involved. And the extent to which the courts have access to those, that kind of information is likely to be limited in national security cases. It will, of course, in some ways vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, depending on certain elements of the institutional setup. So when we come to think about whether they're going to make the right sorts of decisions, whether we're going to get the decisions we want out of them, there are particular questions relating to their competence which arise in national security cases, maybe don't arise in cases where they're either scrutinising legislative action or where they're scrutinising executive action, whereby they're entitled to rather more information about the reasons lying behind the decisions. Certainly there are other questions we can ask as to their competence, and we'll want to know about how they're appointed and their background and how representative they are and the extent to which they're isolated from other parts of the political process, the extent to which they're subject to public opinion, whether they have life tenure, these kinds of questions. So this is the first question as to whether we get the kind of decisions we want out of the courts in times of crisis, whether they make bad decisions, whether they just follow public opinion, whether they just follow the lead of the executive. So that's one question. But a separate question really is, can we trust the courts in these contexts to make any kind of a difference? Can we, for example, trust that our civil liberties will be upheld if the courts do make the right sort of decisions? So it's not a question about whether they're making the right kinds of decisions. It's a question of whether the decisions they make have any real meaningful impact in times of crisis. Courts, of course, are reactive institutions. They're slow and cumbersome institutions. They react to cases which are brought before them. And so if we're looking, for example, at cases where we have individuals imprisoned without trial, it can take a very long time for their cases to be brought before the courts. And very often the case can be completely moot by the time the judicial process has run its course. In fact, in relation to the case that Professor Simpson was describing, it seemed to me almost as if the individual may have been kept in detention longer precisely in order for the case to be resolved. So had there been no case pending, this individual would have been released earlier. So there's a question certainly about whether they're the right kind of institutions to uphold civil liberties, given their lack of effective powers. And of course, it's important in this context that we see that the courts often find themselves up against not just the executive, but also the legislature. Because in these times of crisis, it's extremely common, if we look at recent experience, for the legislatures pretty much to roll over and give executives what they want. And so, in particular, I mean, so one institutional question, you might think, turns on the ability of the executive to change the law, to use the legislature, to get the policy outcomes it wants. So, for example, if it's simply the case that all the courts can do is determine whether the executive is acting within the terms of the law as it stands, if the executive effectively has the power to remake the law in the event of a judgment which it doesn't like, then that power in the hands of the judges is very limited. Certainly in the British case, in relation to, for example, Northern Ireland, one saw that a great number of times, and one sees it to a certain extent now in the USA in relation to the Guantanamo Bay detainees. Now, obviously, that power is going to be greater in a parliamentary sovereignty context, where Parliament can, in theory, at least prior to the ECHR, make or unmake any law. But increasingly, and so there might be a question as to whether what judges are doing is upholding some external higher law. And in cases where that can be used against the executive, there may be more scope for judges to uphold these kinds of civil liberties. But even in these cases, we might be sceptical about the extent to which a court is really going to be able to limit an executive in a time of a national security crisis if it very much wants to promote a certain end. I should finish. And so the third thing I was going to say was simply this. It might be that one question we can ask also is whether there are things we can do to bolster the role of the courts, to change institutions, to, in fact, bring about outcomes where we feel happier to trust the courts in these cases. But that is a difficult question, and it might be that this isn't a kind of case where institutional engineering is in fact the right way to bring about the kind of outcomes we want. Rather than a question of institutional design, it might be a question of political culture. It's striking that the jurisdictions where the courts in these kind of cases have been able to have most impact, one thinks perhaps of Germany, of Israel, of India, are cases where the standing of the judiciary is very high within society. And so there might be some kind of a vicious cycle here. It might be that we can only trust the courts in a context where the courts are themselves trusted. And in the absence of that high degree of public trust, which affords a certain kind of judicial independence, no amount of institutional tinkering will give the courts the kind of power that they actually need if they are to hold executives to account.